Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness, produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
On today's show, America is emerging from a losing battle, and that's the war on fat. In 1980, the publication Dietary Guidelines for Americans advised against eating too much fat, saturated fat, and cholesterol, citing a relationship between fat intake and heart disease. Since then, on average, Americans have gained weight. And today, more than 2 in 3 adults are overweight or obese. We now know that eating fat is not the problem.
The new battlefront is sugar, especially added sugar. The FDA's new nutrition facts label reflects this concern and highlights not only total sugars, but also added sugars. But some experts feel that we should approach sugar the way we did fat and focus on eating a low sugar to no sugar diet.
This approach is such a sea change in nutrition and health that we're devoting the entire show this week to the topic, is sugar bad for us?
Because let's face it, you sacrifice a lot to stay healthy and avoid temptations in food and drink, but you do indulge in the occasional sweet treat. And if you're not gaining weight or are at risk for diabetes, what's the harm in eating sugar 2 to 3 times a week?
You won't want to hear this, but a growing body of science-based evidence indicates consuming even a small amount of sugar has a significant negative effect on your body. Beyond diabetes and excess weight, sugar consumption plays a role in heart disease, cancer, stroke, and autoimmune disease. Our guest for this show turned the world on its ear when the New York Times Magazine published his article, Is Sugar Toxic?, back in April 2011. Now he's out with a new book on the subject, The Case Against Sugar. Investigative science journalist Gary Taubes is the author of 4 other books and has won numerous awards for his work. He's co-founder of the Nutrition Science Initiative and joins us from his office in Oakland, California.
Gary, thank you for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What prompted you to target sugar? Because when your article came out in April 2011, that was not really a big debate at the time. And you said something that really rattled a lot of people's cages. Were you prompted by the obesity epidemic, or was there something else?
Well, for that answer, let me give you a little bit of background just on my I'm not a doctor. I'm not a PhD nutritionist. I was an investigative science journalist my whole career. And by the late 90s, I was doing a series of investigations for the journal Science on, first, on whether salt causes high blood pressure, and then whether dietary fat is a cause of heart disease. You know, the sort of iconic idea of a healthy diet is that it's low in fat and low in salt to begin with. And the evidence for that, as I found out through these year-long investigations, was just really substandard. I mean, it wasn't enough to convince anyone who hadn't been told personally by God that fat and salt were bad for them. And while I was doing that, yes, clearly there was an obesity and diabetes epidemic that was ramping up that we first became aware of in 1995, and by 98 to 2000 had sort of exploded on the scene, and everybody was curious. And I did my first sort of infamous cover story for the New York Times on what was the cause of this obesity epidemic, and that was, you know, the argument I was making is it wasn't dietary fat and it certainly wasn't salt, but there was a very good argument to be made for the carbohydrates, sugars and refined grains and starches, because in the 1960s, those were still considered universally fattening. And by the 1980s, coincident with the beginning of the epidemic, they had become, in effect, heart-healthy diet foods. And our government was even, you know, pushing the food industry to create low-fat products. And in order to make those low-fat products tasty, the food industry was replacing the fat with sugar and high-fructose corn syrup, which is effectively the equivalent of sugar. So that was been my work since 2002. And my first book was about all this science and the history, and I can safely say I did more historical research on the understanding of diabetes and obesity and the relationship to diet than any human being alive at that point. But there was always this question hanging out there, what about sugar specifically? Because time and time again, when clinicians noticed that they were dealing with a diabetes epidemic, so in the U.S., diabetes goes from a very rare disease in the 19th century, one that would occasionally show up in hospital records occasionally to a disease by the 1920s where you have physicians who are becoming diabetes specialists to today where 1 in 11 Americans have diabetes. And this happens all over the world whenever populations go through a transition from whatever their native diet is to Western diets. And so throughout history, you'd have these researchers saying, geez, it looks like it's a sugar. Suddenly we're consuming a heck of a lot of sugar, and with it, we have a heck of a lot of diabetes. And in the 1960s, when biochemists were coming up with a lot of mechanisms which seemed to link sugar to the fundamental defect in type 2 diabetes, the common form, which is a condition called insulin resistance. So by 2011, it's just clearly somebody had to write this book sort of redirecting the discussion on sugar away from this idea that it's just empty calories that we consume in excess to asking this question, you know, is it literally toxic, not in the short term, but in the long term over years and, you know, decades, not over
weeks. So you're saying that the research was literally out there, because you mentioned this was historical research. There's been medical research talking about the problems of sugar, but for some reason, we as a society or I don't know, medical organizations didn't really go in that direction. But the evidence was there.
Yeah, it was always there, was always in the literature, was always a part of the discussion. And what I found, for instance, in 1924, the New York City Public Health Commissioner publishes a paper saying, look, we've had 15-fold increases in diabetes mortality in some American cities since the end of World War II, and this coincides with this massive increase in sugar consumption and the creation of the soft drink industry and the candy and chocolate. And suddenly our kids are eating sugar at a level they've never before had access to, and it seems like sugar is the obvious cause. And you could see that whenever sugar consumption goes up, and he shows these charts in the U.S. and Canada and Europe, you know, you see increasing rates of diabetes. And the leading diabetes specialist of the 20th century, who was at the time who wrote all the textbooks, was a wonderful Boston physician named Elliot Joslin. He was a very thoughtful guy, but he knew nothing. If he had been taught biochemistry in college, he forgot it. And he assumed that there was no difference between sugar and any other carbohydrate, like rice or wheat. And so he said, look, the Japanese eat plenty of carbohydrates, and they don't have diabetes, therefore sugar can't be to blame. And Joslin was so influential in this field, and all physicians, if they wanted to treat diabetes, they read Joslin's textbooks. He almost single-handedly directed attention away from sugar. And the same thing happened in heart disease in the 1960s and 1970s with researchers who thought fat was the cause of heart disease. And here comes the most influential British nutritionist, John Yudkin, to say, you know, it looks like sugar to me, sugar's the prime suspect. And it's, you know, the disagreements weren't settled on the basis of the evidence. They were settled on the basis of who yelled louder, who argued more, and who had the bigger constituency. And in the U.S., it was a fellow named Ansel Keys who thought fat caused heart disease. And then the sugar industry gets involved with a public relations campaign to back the anti-fat people against the anti-sugar people, and we come out of it once again with this idea that sugar's harmless. And then we just don't do the research for 20 to 30 years because anyone who studies it is perceived as sort of quackish because they think sugar isn't harmless.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
We're talking to award-winning science journalist Gary Taubes. His latest book, The Case Against Sugar, just getting a little history. Let's talk about sugar itself. Is it all forms of sugar? Just so that people listening understand clearly what you are suggesting. So questions like, is it just added sugar? Is it high fructose corn syrup? Is it natural sugar, like if you eat an orange? And what about if you drink wine? So for a lay audience, just help us understand, is it all forms of sugar that are bad for us overall?
Okay, so I guess the question would be, what are we talking, what am I talking about when I'm talking about sugar? And So when we talk about, you know, added sugars, we're talking about beet sugar, cane sugar, and high fructose corn syrup. And they're all roughly 50-50 combinations of these two simple carbohydrates, glucose and fructose. And it's the fructose that makes them sweet, and it's the fructose that sets them apart from the carbs in, say, potatoes or bread, which will break down to mostly glucose alone. The fructose happens to be metabolized in our liver, where the glucose is metabolized in every cell in our body, and the problems I'm talking about, this insulin resistance condition and a related condition called fatty liver disease, start in the liver. And so fructose and sugar are the prime suspects. The thing is, the toxicologists will talk about the dose makes the poison. So when we consume the sugar in an apple, for instance, an apple, a medium-sized apple is about 85% water, and what isn't water are fiber, which we don't digest, and then sugar and fructose, sucrose and fructose. But because most of the apple is water and the apple's got fiber in it, which slows down the digestion of the sugars, when you eat an apple, you get a relatively small dose of sugar and you digest it slowly. The same amount of sugar in an apple might be the equivalent of the sugar in 2 ounces of apple juice, which you know, is one or two swallows, which are then had no fiber attached. You don't have to break down the apple itself to get to the sugar, so you digest the sugar quickly. And what we care about is the dose of the sugars we're consuming and how quickly we digest them, and maybe what else we're eating with them, which is a longer conversation. So as sugar came to saturate our diets, the doses just skyrocketed. Like I said, we get 20, 30 times the dose of sugar that we used to get, plus we digest them. If you consume sugary beverages, it's sort of instantaneous absorption into the system. And so while they're the same sugars, you get a much smaller dose in fruit, and then you digest them much more slowly. That said, here's the caveat. We tend to give public health advice in this country. We give public health advice in this country to everyone equally as though they all should be eating the same diet. And that means, you know, the 120-pound, 5'4" marathoner should be eating the same diet, burning the same fuel, in effect, as the 300-pounder who never gets off his or her couch, or the diabetic. And we know that these foods have dramatically different effects on sort of hormonal status in the body, and particularly this hormone insulin, which is the problem in diabetes. So one of the things I've been arguing is that in obesity and diabetes, even though fruit would be harmless if not benevolent to our marathon runner, it's not doing any favor to the obese or diabetic individual who have to secrete insulin to what they would call cover the fruit, the carbohydrates in the fruit. And that makes me a very controversial figure in the field, even saying that fruit might not be healthy for roughly 50% of the American population.
You get a lot of pushback on that, I'm sure, because so many people told to switch over from, you know, if you need to have something sweet, we're told, turn away from processed foods, shop the edges of your supermarket, and go to the fruit section. And you're saying, not so much.
Well, again, not if you're obese and diabetic, particularly the diabetic. If you have to take insulin to cover the fruit, you have to ask yourself, would you be healthier if you didn't eat the fruit at all? And historically, even if you look at our fruit consumption, you know, fruit's obviously seasonal. And so historically, we would have seasons where we would consume, you know, some fruit, and then most of the year you wouldn't get any fruit at all. So even if it was literally fattening, and you could find statements and, you know, going back to ancient Rome where the slaves are getting fatter during fig season, and somebody's wondering why that's so. I always forget if it's Aristotle or Socrates. You can imagine that if you have fruit season all year round, like we do today, something that was a seasonal delicacy and that becomes something that year round causes sort of the chronic accumulation of fat and some issues with this insulin signaling and blood sugar. So You know, these are, again, they're not particularly popular arguments, but I feel somebody has to be making them publicly.
And we're glad you're on Take Care talking to us about this very subject. Now, I have read some interviews with you since your book came out, and I've discovered the question I'm going to ask you is a popular question. You've heard it many, many times, I'm sure from your own family members and friends. And that is there a threshold of sugar that can be consumed without doing harm? And I say that so many of us don't want to have to hear what you're saying and give up sugar entirely. And what about the case for moderation? If you're otherwise healthy and you exercise and you don't have diabetes and you're a normal weight, what is the harm in having dessert three times a week?
Okay, so now I'm going to say there are two things. The last chapter of my book is called How Little is Still Too Much, and it's in effect a meditation, an essay on the concept of moderation in a situation like this. And my thinking, it was impossible to write this book without it being defined by my own personal experience and two facts in particular. One, I have two pre-adolescent boys. And, you know, moderating their sugar consumption is clearly a primary, you know, role of parenting in this day and age, only matched recently by moderating their screen consumption. And I used to be a smoker, okay? So as a former cigarette smoker, smokers will tell you this, they can't imagine life without cigarettes any more than the rest of us could imagine life without sugar. I mean, the deleterious effects of cigarettes tend to be more noticeable and more obviously cigarette-related, like coughing and bad breath, and you smell bad, and you're wheezing, things like that. So you have more immediate reason to think you will be healthier if you quit, but the addiction is such that you can't imagine life without smoking. And even smokers will tell you that a meal doesn't officially end when you're a smoker until you've had your post-cigarette meal, just as when you're talking about dessert, it's like a meal without dessert seems like a cheat. So when I talk about this, there are two aspects. What is the level at which people can be healthy? So you can consume moderate sugar, and clearly, you know, again, if you're lean and healthy today and you're not obese or diabetic, then, you know, dessert three times a week would probably be fine. The key word being fine, probably. And then it's probably not going to shorten your life by any significant amount. By that, I mean, maybe if you didn't eat any desserts, you might live 6 months or a year longer. Who knows, maybe 2 weeks longer, maybe not at all. I mean, these statistics are funny things. The question is, first, there's the people who are predisposed to gain weight. And I think through arguments I make in the book, we have more of those with each generation, because in part this problem is passed down from mother to child in the womb and what's called the intrauterine environment. But then there's this question of addiction. And the way I think about it is, clearly there's a level of cigarette smoking you could do and almost assuredly not get heart disease, emphysema, or lung cancer. But we don't say too many cigarettes cause lung cancer. We say cigarettes cause lung cancer. We don't advise smokers to smoke in moderation. We advise smokers not to smoke because, A, we know it's addictive, and, B, we think, well, nobody really has to smoke. We have to eat. We don't have to smoke. So some of us can clearly tolerate a dessert a week, and it's not going to dominate our lives. Some of us can eat sugar in moderation. It's not going to dominate our lives. And some of us, once we start eating sugar, are going to think about it as much as smokers will think about cigarettes or alcoholics will think about alcohol if they're trying to smoke or drink in moderation. And for those people, I want to say, you know who you are. It might be easier and probably is easier, and I'm one of them. It's much easier for me to consume no sugar than to try and consume it in moderation. As soon as I try and consume it in moderation, I am thinking about even having this conversation.
A dangerous path to go on. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And we're talking with investigative science journalist Gary Taubes. He penned an article in 2011, Is Sugar Toxic?, and followed up recently with a book, The Case Against Sugar. And Gary has been talking about the sad reality that probably no sugar is best for us. And that also includes naturally occurring sugars, such as in fruits. Gary, you talk about the energy balance theory in your book. And the idea that has always been there, that to combat obesity, you just need to eat fewer calories and exercise more. You have an issue with this.
Yeah, to me, and again, this is, as I said earlier, I had the opportunity to do more research on the history of obesity science and diabetes science and nutrition than probably any human being alive. And so since the 1950s, the conventional wisdom has been, look, you get fat because you take in more calories than you expend. It's that simple. And that turns it into a behavioral disorder, eating too much and exercising too little. And virtually all of our research is trying to figure out why people eat too much. All of our guidelines aim at trying to get people to eat less and exercise more. So that's the paradigm by which we understand obesity. And it's funny, there are vociferous proponents of this. I mean, people who will tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm a quack to argue otherwise. And my response would be, the funny thing is they can't tell you why they believe that and where it comes from and who first came up with that idea, because someone did, and why it was accepted over a competing idea, whereas I can, because I've actually done the history. So the competing idea, which came out of Germany and Austria in the first half of the 20th century, pre-World War II, they had concluded that obesity was clearly a hormonal regulatory defect, just like any other growth defect. So if you see someone walking down the street who's 8 feet tall, you don't worry about how much they're eating and exercising. If you're a doctor, you think, I got to put that guy in my MRI machine so I could identify the tumor in his pituitary gland that's making him over-secrete growth hormone. Being 8 feet tall, or as an adult being reaching only 4 feet tall, are either too much growth hormone or too little growth hormone. They're all endocrine disorders. And these Germans and Austrians said, clearly obesity is an endocrine disorder too. It's got to be, and I could go through all the reasons. Then World War II comes along. The German and Austrian school vanishes. The lingua franca of medical science shifts from German to English over the course of the war, because post-war, all major medical science is now being done in the U.S. by many people, young physicians and researchers who fought in the war. And they hate the Germans, and they don't speak German. They're not going to read the literature. So suddenly you have this recreation of obesity as an eating disorder. And then the 1960s come along, and people studying the hormones that regulate fat accumulation in fat cells identify insulin as the hormone that dominates in putting fat in fat cells. And if insulin does what it does, and there's no debate about this, then the insulin responds to the carbohydrate content of our diet, and it implicates carbohydrates as uniquely fattening. And again, the ones that we digest quickly, the refined grains and potatoes, not the green carbs and green vegetables, and particularly sugar. And so you've got this story, it all ties in to carbs, and we just didn't want to hear that for a variety of reasons we've discussed. So in the 1970s, the researchers dominating the field of obesity, and it's basically a half dozen white men who are doctors and not scientists, and they're not good at thinking critically, and they decide they don't like this idea that carbs cause obesity, because if it's true, then you've got to tell people to eat low-carb, high-fat diets, which is what Dr. Atkins was doing, and they didn't like Atkins. So over the course of the 1970s, they basically eradicate this endocrine hypothesis of obesity and all the underlying science behind it, throwing out the bathwater, the baby, because they didn't like the bathwater, which was Atkins and his diet book. And by 1980, you've got this field that's studying obesity, which is a disorder of excess fat accumulation, without paying any attention to the hormones and enzymes that actually regulate fat accumulation in fat cells.
Gary, we have less than a minute left with you.
Yeah.
The book is The Case Against Sugar, and you have researched this. You're passionate about the subject. What do you think has to happen in order for medical practitioners and the general public to embrace your approach? What is it going to take to settle this issue?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of physicians, I would say thousands by now, who have embraced this approach because they see how much it helps their patients. So there's this kind of remarkable efficacy of sugar-free, low-carbohydrate, high-fat diets, and physicians are buying in. The medical organizations have to buy in, which unfortunately means they have to acknowledge that they made mistakes and gave us the wrong advice, and it's hard to imagine that. And the scientists have to buy in, and that requires that they do the right science. So I'm hoping this will be a revolution from the bottom up because patients and, you know, individuals can go on these diets and see how well they work themselves, and physicians can see that they can finally make their patients healthy rather than giving them drugs for their symptoms, their blood pressure, their cholesterol. They could actually teach them how to eat that will resolve their symptoms.
Investigative science journalist Gary Taubes is the author of The Case Against Sugar. He is a co-founder of the Nutrition Science Initiative and spoke to us from his office in Oakland, California. Gary, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, guys. That was great.